Hey, everybody. It's the Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And Stephen, today, big day for baseball writers everywhere. A couple of big days in a row. I mean, they had the Hall of Fame thing yesterday. Today, a lot of them getting their resumes in order because there's a Supreme Court seat that is now open. A lot of those judgy guys, the top gig is now available.
Yes, that's I could. I'm not sure if you're allowed to chew tobacco on the bench, but that might be a problem for some of them.
Yeah, I think it's generally frowned upon. All right. Listen, don't be afraid. I'm not bringing up the Hall of Fame. You're getting a little bit of a reprieve. Although, I mean, we're talking to Adnan Virk at the bottom of the hour here. We might have to bring it up ever so briefly. Will you consent to that?
Yeah, I think that's that. You know, like normally it's once a year, like, you know, Christmas, like once a year is enough. But yeah. With Adnan coming up, I would like to we'll let him do his 3 minutes of Adnan on it. That'd be fine by me.
Yeah, methinks he probably has a screed ready to go. So that's coming up at 5:30. Let's start here because man. It's felt like a long time coming, and the thirst for seeing the national soccer team play again in its quest to qualify for the upcoming World Cup. People they've been waiting for this for a long, long time, and I know Sunday is the big match against the Americans at Tim Hortons Field, which I assume is now sold out. The presale was yesterday. I didn't see an update on that. I can't imagine any tickets were available today after the presale where the original ticket buyers were given the first crack at things. So that's the big event, the one home match in this three-match World Cup qualification window. But it starts in earnest tomorrow, and it starts in San Pedro Sula. John Herdman did his media availability today. There was actually some news out of it. Steven Eustachio has not been ruled out for even tomorrow's match, despite the fact that he's not even with the squad right now. He was named to the squad, so eligible to play, and he just needs to be apparently cleared by a doctor. So that would be a huge, huge bonus to have him in the lineup. Speaking of the lineup, there are three men on this squad, Milian Borjan, Atiba Hutchison, and Lucas Cavallini, that were on the squad almost 10 years ago. Yes, that 8-1 squad where all they needed was a draw in San Pedro Sula, not to qualify for the Olympics, it should be noted, to get into the hex, the final stage of qualifying, which they are in now, which is no longer the hex. But that was almost 10 years ago, Stephen. Will that be on your mind when we watch the Canadian men take to the field in Honduras tomorrow?
That will 100% be. I hope for those three guys they don't have PTSD going back there. Again, I'm not joking. That was a bad experience, right? A really bad experience for everybody who went there. Now I have a less bad memory of it because I was in Toronto in a TV studio working with Jerry Dobson and Craig Forrest. We were hosting doing the pre and post on that match and then halftime. The ever intrepid Arash Madani was in San Pedro Sula with the squad, so he was the brave one. But you know, we went into, I remember, you know, and again, I'm not trying to, like, this is a very different situation, this World Cup qualifying, but you know, it was one of those kind of high hopes days, and could Canada come through, and you know, Canada's chances to get to a World Cup, and you know, all, and it's a team they in theory should have been able to get a result against. And yes, it was hard playing on the road, and Craig told his stories about playing in horrible places and having horrible things thrown at him, and then off we went into the match, and you know, it went so far south so fast. And you know, I poor Arash on the sidelines sweating, and look, I know there are parts of Honduras that are apparently quite nice. I'm told. I know a couple of Hondurans. I got a fishing guide buddy who's a Honduran. He's a great guy. Where he comes from, it's apparently very nice. It's not very nice in San Pedro Sula. Like, it's really not nice at all. It's a tough place and a very, very dangerous place. And there are many horrible drug gangs who kind of hold sway over it. And then there's soccer, you know, where, yes, people are passionate. And if you're a visiting team, pretty much anything goes. And it wasn't just a defeat, right? It was like a soul-sucking, horrible surrender that kind of summed up every frustration anybody who's followed the Canadian men's national team over the years has had. You know, there have been the odd glimmer since 86. They won a gold cup, But mostly it's just been an excuse to get your heart broken over and over again. And that one was a crusher, right? It was because it was over.
It doesn't get worse than 8-1.
No, 8-1 in soccer doesn't happen that often, you know, unless you're playing against San Marino or Andorra or something. And it just, and there, I remember talking on the halftime break with the guys trying to fill that space with.
It was, you know, only like, 4-0 at that point. So yeah, were you hopeful for a comeback?
No, we weren't actually. No, we couldn't even fake it. And then we cut to a rash, and he was perspiring. And I remember that. I think the story was, as I recall, that, you know, they flew them down there on a charter plane that was not like a, like they just, you know, the idea when you go down to a place like that is get into town and get out of town as fast as you can, right? Like, even sometimes don't even overnight in a hotel, because they'll set up outside your hotel and, you know, bang pots and pans and set off explosives all night to keep you awake. Get in and get out. So they were, the getting out, you know, that's, people were chucking things at them, chucking fluids and bags at them. And then they get on this bus, and people are rocking the bus and throwing things at them. And they get on this plane that's like, you know, kind of the larger version of like the Buddy Holly plane, right? It's just
oh my goodness,
barely getting off the ground. I think it had propellers, and I guarantee everybody there, including Arash, probably, you know, came out a little traumatized by that experience. It was awful. So yeah, back to the scene of the crime, but when it's different, right? It's going to be different, right?
Totally,
right?
Well, I mean, the stakes are a little different. Yeah, and Honduras stinks. Although it should be noted, and you go check out the oral history of that match on Sportsnet.ca, written by Mike Kareen today, because there's some great anecdotes. Yeah, adding to what you just said, and we'll talk to Craig Forrest tomorrow in the lead up to that match. But yeah, this is a different deal. Canada in this stage of qualifying has yet to lose. Now, knock on wood, and there's no Alphonso Davies, and there might not be Stephen Eustachio, but they're at the top of the table. Guess who's dead last? Honduras. Mm-hmm. They've yet to win in this stage of qualifying. Now, that being said, Mike Kareen also in that story mentions that they have a very high expected goal differential throughout this stage, and perhaps have been a little bit unlucky. And yeah, we know in CONCACAF anything can happen. I wonder, Stephen, and we'll talk a little bit more about this with Christian Jack later, but this Canadian squad has been so impressive because they've been so positive in their play, right? Like, all they've done every time they've stepped on the field is try to score goals. Doesn't matter. The Azteca, whatever. Who cares? Down 1-0? Who cares? We're gonna keep coming at you. Taking the lead, keep coming at you. Never stop. No fear. I wonder if that is cowed a little bit. I don't know if John Herdman would ever admit to this, but you really are in such a good position. Your squad is decimated right now. I mean, you lose the best player in CONCACAF, one of the 11 best players on planet Earth. Stephen Eustachio, even if he does come back and play, he probably hasn't been out of his room in what, a couple of weeks here. I wonder if you do, especially for this one tomorrow, where it is a hostile environment. I know they're dead last on the table, but don't you just try to play for a point in this one, don't you?
Yeah, a point it would be fine, right? That's number one. Like, that's what you need, a result. And look, I'm not saying they could lose and it'd be fine, but, you know, where they are in the tables right now, they've got some wiggle room. You know, they've given themselves, it's because it's not just, you know, how much distance is between them and 1 and 2 and 1 and 3. It's between them and 5. Because I know the fourth place, you have to go into a crossover and you have to play probably New Zealand in a one-off on a neutral site. But that's still not, you know, if that's the case, if that's where they wound up to get to the World Cup, that's a pretty good outcome, and Canada would be favored.
They're 7 points up on Costa Rica, which is 5th.
There you go. So they're in a good spot. So they have built themselves a cushion here, number one. So yeah, you go in there and get a point, it would be a success. And number two, they don't give you extra points for style in this game.
No.
You know, you don't. No one cares, right? You could play this as ugly as you want, and just be kind of efficient, and but just trying to grind out a result and then get the hell out of town. But I'll tell you, the flip side of that has been, like, we have not seen John Herdman do that with this team.
Yep. No.
They have played on their front foot, as you say. They went into the Azteca and they didn't play that way in the Azteca. They didn't park the bus in the Azteca. It was like, no, we played these guys in the Gold Cup. We can play them even up. We can beat them. and we're not afraid. And I think the not afraid part, you know, like there's a lot of stuff that goes into team building in soccer, and I'm not going to pretend to understand, you know, the game tactically the way John Herdman understands it tactically or Craig Forrest understands it tactically, but you know, John's a very good in-game coach, and I think he's been very smart, and he's been flexible tactically. But the biggest thing he's done is get these guys to believe they can win. You know, and it sounds corny, but you know, this is a team, a program that has no real history of succeeding in these situations, and he's got them believing they can beat anybody in the world. So why would you go into Honduras and play scared if that's been the key, one of the keys to your success all through this has been, no, we're not scared. We're not scared of the Azteca. We're not scared of the Americans. We're not scared of anybody in this. So why would you go to San Pedro Sula and be scared of a team that's not as good as you are? So I think they will play, you know. You know, maybe if they get a lead, maybe they'll be a little conservative. Maybe they'll protect it a little bit. But my expectation is that they'll play the way they played in this entire qualifying, which is, you know, we're going to attack.
Well, and not that they didn't attack in the home fixture, because I was at that one. Brought my kid to that match at BMO Field against Honduras. It was a draw. They did draw against Honduras at home, but that was the first match of this entire window, if I recall. And, you know, there was some nervousness, I think, from that squad, especially in the first half of that thing. But that was... If you're expecting a feast for the eyes tomorrow, I think you might be disappointed with what you get, because that first thing at BMO Field, my kid was into it mostly because, you know, he had popcorn and cotton candy, but it was a lot of flopping all over the place and time wasting, because the Hondurans want to point out of this thing too, especially if they score early. Oh man, the final part of this game could be a mess.
Yeah, they're not, talk about, you know, the aesthetics and style points. No, they are going to, they're not going to qualify for the World Cup. So they really, that's not in the cards here. But, you know, playing in front of their home fans, it's not like they're going to roll over either. It'll be ugly. There'll be lots of flopping. There'll be lots of time wasting. There'll be lots of theatrics. There will be work in the referee. There'll be, you know, and there may well end up being some kind of unfairness from a Canadian point of view at a certain point where you think, hang on a second, we just got suckered here, or the referee got intimidated, or like just, you get, you know, as they say, being CONCACAF'd, right? Like our version of being CONCACAF'd is Edmonton in the snow or Hamilton in the snow, you know, so we're playing by those rules now. Their version is, you know, all the stuff that they do to you before you get on the pitch and then all the stuff they do to you on the pitch. And look, Honduras is a little tiny country, right? Precious little resources. We're a great big country with loads of resources. You do what you can do, right? Like, give them credit. They're going to do what, and the game matters to them. And they're a football nation, right? It absolutely 100% matters. Yep. So, but again, I'm thinking John will have these guys mentally ready for that.
I think you're right.
And you know, and I just think, Ben, we've seen so much. You know, there are points in this qualifying where they could have wobbled. You know, even after that first match, the one you're talking about, where they, you know, on home soil against an inferior opponent, you only get 1 point. But you know what? They have grown through this qualifying. So I'd be really disappointed if they don't get a result out of this. I'd be shocked, to be honest.
Yeah, me too. Even though it's as hostile an environment as you can get, unfortunately, Arash Madani will not be making the return to San Pedro Sula. I'm sure he's broken up about it. Before we move off of soccer, FIFA wants to remind us that, you know what? It's not a one-horse race when it comes to the worst sporting organizations in the world. It's not just IOC, okay? They're right there, okay? It's 1 and 1A. FIFA President Gianni Infantino talking about the biannual World Cup today, talking to some politicians in Europe. This is the quote, and there was no follow-up, and there was no exact reason behind this, but this is among the reasons he believes the World Cup should be played every 2 years. We need to find ways to include the entire world to give hope to Africans so that they don't need to cross the Mediterranean in order to find maybe a better life, but more probably death in the sea. So it's literally the World Cup, Stephen, is a matter of life and death. And if you oppose it, if you, UEFA, oppose it, you want people to die.
You are in favor of death in the sea. That I'm not sure what I can say about that. It is, you're right, it is a two-horse race right now, right? Because, you know, like this, it's, you know, we talked about the late, great Andrew Jennings when he passed a couple of weeks ago. Like, it's no shock that, you know, the two great targets of his investigative reporting were the IOC and FIFA, right? He knew where the good stuff was. But, yeah, that is, I guess the IOC's counter this week is that they said they had another one of their secret conference or Zoom calls with Peng Shui, and she's fine still. She's just doing great.
Right.
So, you know, it's a bit of a contest here between the two of them. But, yeah, that is, it's jaw-dropping, but it's FIFA, right? It's
no. Par for the course.
You know, the World Cup every 2 years, I believe we know why they want to do a World Cup, men's World Cup every 2 years. It's reasonably clear-cut. You know, two times as much money is better than one times as much money every 4 years. So I think it's pretty simple. The trickle down to refugees from Africa or elsewhere, there may be still people who believe in trickle-down economics, but I think that's a long trickle from Lausanne, they're in Zurich, from Zurich to the displaced peoples of the world. Not sure it's going to trickle quite that far. I'm not sure staying at home and watching it on TV is going to keep economic refugees at home. I'm searching for an explanation and I'm failing.
Yeah. And methinks that FIFA's based in Zurich, not because of the chocolate, might be the whole banking thing going
yes.
on there. That
yes, that's no, they're there for the waters. They're there to take the waters and, because everything runs on time. Yes.
Yeah. All right. All right. So you know what, Christopher Clary was bang on when we talked to him at the end of the show yesterday that I'd be able to watch Felix Auger-Aliassime this morning. It was the most pivotal point in the match. Five setters. So the Canadian contingent now done at the Australian Open. A fine showing for both Denis Shapovalov and Felix Auger-Aliassime as they both go out in five sets in the quarterfinals. And for my money, Felix's effort was more encouraging. They were both encouraging. I would say that Shapovalov, early on in that match against diminished Rafa Nadal, he looked nervous. When you go up two sets to none against a slam champion and Daniil Medvedev, who is maybe the best hard court player outside of Novak Djokovic in the world right now, like that is something. You have a match point in the fourth set and you're only 22, and Medvedev has a lot more experience, but he's 25. I hope the best is yet to come for both of these guys, but you know, when you're in places, and I know they've been deeper in slams before, but at the Australian Open, when you're getting your first taste of these massive, massive event matches on center court in front of Rod Laver, to not completely wilt under the pressure, like this, I think this is encouraging, Stephen.
Oh yeah, it's disappointing in the result, but extraordinarily encouraging in the big picture. There's just no question about it. And yeah, I think you're right. You know, Shapovalov, he runs on high anyway. Like that's a bit of his nature, to say the least. And he did look a little skittish to start that match, but got himself back into that match and had a chance to win that match. You know, against one of the greatest players of all time, but one of the greatest players of all time who's, you know, walking towards the sunset pretty quickly. You know, again, taking nothing. You know, Rafa still could win this tournament. But, you know, what Felix did last night against a guy who, you know, is the successor, right? Really, if you... Federer is probably done. Djokovic, you know, who knows what countries are going to let him in. But, you know, it's his late career. Rafa's definitely late career. Although my guess is Rafa's still going to go back and win the French Open this year. But but Medvedev's the next guy, right? He's... If you want to kind of look at who below those three guys, Medvedev would be the consensus as the number one behind the big three, the former big three. And Felix gave him everything last night and this morning. It was really, really close. He played a great match. And yeah, I say it would have been amazing to see those two Canadians in the semifinals of the Grand Slam. And we're going to see that one of these days. But it feels like progress. And, you know, even if both of them had gone to those matches and gotten smoked in straight sets, you'd still say, well, there is progression here, right? There. But for them to play the way they did on a big stage against big time players and You know, they took care and taking care of business in the early rounds, which is no given. I think it's a crazy time for Canadian tennis. It's really, really exciting.
Yeah, it is. And yes, of course, we already had Bianca win a slam, U.S. Open, and hopefully she gets back on the court real, real soon. And yeah, we've had another Canadian woman reach a final of a slam. And we have these two top 20 men. It's a very strange sport in this country because we're kind of dominant at it. And like the Americans would take the success that the Canadians have had 100 times out of 100. And we have, 10% of the population. And I don't even know what the participation rate is in this country when it comes to tennis. And you know what? The Rogers Cup does reasonably well, but it's not like people are falling over themselves to watch tennis or seemingly play tennis. How has this happened in this country, Stephen? Explain it to me.
Well, it's a really good question because normally there's kind of an echo boom kind of thing, right? Where somebody shows up who's a one-off and popularizes a sport, and then you see the trickle down, kids start to participate, and then it doesn't even have to be one of your own, like Vince Carter. There was a Vince Carter echo in Canadian basketball, right? Like, there's no question about it. Just look at when he was him in Toronto. Look at the guys playing, who play for Canada, all the Canadians in the NBA right now. Do the math, right? They were impressionable youths when Vince was winning the slam dunk contest. It happens. But there's no, like Milos is a different generation of these guys, and he did he had success, didn't win a Grand Slam, but had some success. Jeannie Bouchard on the women's side had some success in Grand Slams, and a predecessor of Leila Fernandez or Bianca. But no, it is a little, I know the Tennis Canada people, and if Arash was here, who knows a lot about the Canadian tennis world, or Damien, they talk about Tennis Canada and development and some of the grassroots stuff that they've done, and that this isn't a fluke. This is part of a plan. But it feels like we went from, occasional bright light to being a world power in what? 18 months, 2 years.
Truly. This is going to be our lives for the next decade. No, I know. And this is going to be our lives for the next decade. And it's tough because the Australian Open is played at these times that are not conducive to really paying attention. But watch when we get into Europe, I guess, when we get to Wimbledon and the French Open. But especially when we get to the U.S. Open and these guys are right there and they're both, already Felix, he was a 9 seed. At this slam, right? Like that's shocking to people. These are highly anticipated matches that both of these men play in against the best players in the entire world. Yeah, perhaps this is the echo boom that we're gonna see in the next decade plus. But yeah, where did they come? I guess kudos to Milos Raonic, who played very much in the era of the big three. But I guess doing what he did. And he was a top player in the world at one point as well, that perhaps that's been the fruits of his labor are kind of presenting themselves right now. But kudos to Dennis and Felix. Leafs-Raptors both in action tonight. Raptors won yesterday, despite the fact that no Fred VanVleet and no anybody, really. Just everybody racked up a ton of minutes. We'll talk to Michael Grange later on. I want to start with the Leafs, though, in the couple minutes we have here before we have to break. Jack Campbell is starting tonight. Peter Mrazek got the start and the win on Saturday against the Islanders. He's under contract for 3 years. Peter Mrazek is going to be paid by somebody, probably the Toronto Maple Leafs, especially if he's as middling as he's been, making $3 million per for the next 3 years. He's going to be a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Now, maybe Jack Campbell is next year, but he's a free agent. The Toronto Maple Leafs have made the commitment to Peter Mrazek, and yes, did Jack Campbell perform well enough to deserve the start in all 7 games against the Montreal Canadiens in the playoffs a season ago? Yes, he did. And did he perform pretty well in that postseason series? Sure. Maybe an iffy goal in Game 7. But yeah, and I wouldn't say that the Montreal Canadiens were exactly an offensive juggernaut. But yeah, you can't argue with the numbers. I think he had like a .930 save percentage. Since he's been a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs, he's been great. He's played half as many games as Peter Mrazek has in his entire career. Peter Mrazek has a longer track record, not just in the regular season. He's played like 30-plus playoff games as well. Stephen, are we not all the way back to where we were at the beginning of the season, but if Jack Campbell continues his trajectory, which, I mean, who in their right mind expected him to finish the season with a 940 save percentage, and he still had a save percentage over 900 over his last, you know, half dozen starts, but it's like 910, not 940. 910 is about where Peter Mrazek's been his entire career. Are we back to the point where it's, you know what, if it's a 50-50 split and Peter Mrazek outplays Jack Campbell, that you might be tempted to give him a little bit more of a look?
I guess what I would say is, which guy gives you the better chance to win the Stanley Cup this year? And I know that sounds self-evident, but like it's not about development here, and it's not about next year, and it's not about the year after that. Their goal has to be to win the Stanley Cup this year, right? That's they're built to win the Stanley Cup this year. And I know people will scoff at the notion of winning the Stanley Cup this year, but that's the plan here, folks. This is not the window is open, and is as open as it's going to get. And this group is going to, there are going to be expectations, and that should be the expectation, right? Win the Stanley Cup. It's not guaranteed, obviously, but win the Stanley. So which of these two guys gives you the best chance to win the Stanley Cup? And it doesn't, like, yeah, Mrazek's going to, they do have two more years after this year with him under contract, and they don't have any more years under contract with Campbell after this year. But, you know, that somebody's going to have to make a call here. And I think to this point in the season, the call would still be the guy who had a 947 save percentage not that long ago. Because, yeah. Look, that's like, what are the elements to a team getting through four rounds in the playoffs? Like, element one is goaltending, correct?
Yeah.
Like, that's element one. And it can be a guy who you know was great, or a guy who becomes great, or a guy who becomes great in the middle of the first round when he subs in for the other guy, right? It's just all kinds of history. So, yeah, I still think it's about getting Jack Campbell to the beginning of the playoffs healthy and fresh and confident and ready to go, unless he completely falls apart. Like, that's, and having Peter Mrazek healthy and refreshed and ready to go in if Jack Campbell falls apart in the game two of the first round. And whatever happens after this year happens after this year. You know, because if it doesn't, if things don't, you know, pan out this year with a nice playoff run, a variety of people probably won't have their jobs anymore. So, yeah, let's, this is about, this is, as you know, it's not, again, it's not like a team is going to age out or anything, but in a cap system, you know, where, you know, you can only kind of keep all of your pieces together for so long, the windows are really narrow, and they're in it, right? Like they say, this is, you know, it's not, you know, it is kind of must win, right? So it's must win some playoff games for sure, but you know, they should enter April. They should finish April thinking, you know, we can win the Stanley Cup.
Mm-hmm. I'm just the goaltending. I wouldn't even call it a battle to this point, but yeah, watching the individual goaltending performances is becoming more interesting to me, and we'll see what Jack Campbell does after Mrazek finally had maybe his best game as a Leaf on Saturday in a 3-1 win over the Islanders tonight against the Ducks on Sportsnet. When we come back, we will talk to Adnan Virk, MLB Network, NHL Network, GM Shuffle Podcast, and also Cinephile, the Adnan Virk movie podcast. I talked to him about Power of the Dog last week. Maybe he's apparently reviewing American Underdog on Cinephile this week, Steven. So we'll talk to him about that. Maybe we'll talk about who in sports deserves a movie. Go ahead.
And you know what, Ben? Next week, on Monday, we can go to the movies again, I believe.
Holy cow.
Aren't our masters allowing us back into the cinemas next week? I'm not sure. I haven't, and again, I'm not joking. Have we checked the popcorn? Or do we know if popcorn's on now? Because the last time I went, you couldn't have popcorn.
Oh, man. I don't know. You know what? We'll use the break to figure out what the rules are on Monday and perhaps, plan to go see a film on Monday. That's exciting. I can go to a restaurant, too. Wow. Super exciting. All right.
You both.
Adnan Virk
next. Dinner and a film.
Yeah, that used to be a thing people did. I'll try to rekindle the before times on Monday. All right. Adnan Virk next. Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Hey, everybody, it's Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Annis and Stephen Brunt, and our friend Adnan Virk, MLB Network, NHL Network, the GM Shuffle Podcast, Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast. I know you were listening to the show in the last segment because you always do. You always do your research. Are you happy for us that we get to see movies again on Monday?
It's phenomenal news. I was actually just talking to my parents last week about it. I said, God, when are these restrictions being lifted? People need to be able to go see West Side Story or Scream or Spider-Man again. Like, Jeff Blair can't stop talking how much he loves Spider-Man. He can go see it again. So I'm thrilled for you guys. I love the fact Brunt is a fellow cinephile. I mean, this is amazing news for me.
Well, I was in transit last Wednesday when you were on, and I understand that you did not. You spoke disparagingly about Power of the Dog, which I wish I'd seen it in a real movie theater with that great score and that it's so beautiful. But
looked beautiful.
You know, watched it on my crappy TV, and I thought it was pretty great.
Johnny Greenwood, great score, by the way. Again, we've talked about Paul Thomas Anderson, you and me, a couple of times. Phantom Thread, he did the score for. People know him for Radiohead. Listen, I love a good score, okay? Well, that's not going to give this movie four Maple Leafs. And I love Jane Campion. Listen, a female director, right, did the piano. Yep. It's beautifully shot. But listen, as a Paul Thomas Anderson guy, Brunt, you know they're aping quite a bit of There Will Be Blood. Like, everyone's raving about Benedict Cumberbatch. I'm like, well, I think he just watched Daniel Day-Lewis's Daniel Plainview, and he nailed the whole menacing tone and all the rest of it. I just felt like, Ben, the climax, the payoff didn't come for me. I get the unsettling tone and the whole idea of male repressed sexuality. But beyond the movie, I go, that's it? Like, it's a very cold, clinical movie. To me, it's a real cry from Belfast, which I think should be the best picture from it.
I'm very high on Belfast. I thought it was. I did see that before they closed the doors. And Belfast is awesome. And I make sure no spoiler. We will not. No spoilers on Power of the Dog. People should still see it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I hated the piano, by the way. So I'm not necessarily. I thought it was interminable. I just thought it was miserable, and I couldn't wait for it to end. But a lot of miserable people. But anyway. So I like this one a lot better. So we agree on some things. We will disagree on others, and that's the way. But I want to hear about. I know we got to talk about actual sports, but you review Kurt Warner. Like, I was thinking, movies about sports, movies about football. Like, you know, there's Longest Yard and Semi Tough and Paper Lion and Heaven Can Wait, sort of.
Yeah.
Mostly degrees of crappy, but there's some like. Give me the capsule review. I don't want to, people should go to your own review of this as well, but give me the version for our show.
Yeah, please check out Cinephile for the full review, but I will spoil nothing by saying it was exactly what I was expecting it to be, which is a cookie-cutter biopic. And the real frustration is this. As you said, I'm totally fine with a crappy football movie. Like, as long as there's football, the real disappointment was this is an origin story. These damn superhero movies have intoxicated everybody, so they think we all want origin stories. No, I don't want the origin story. I want the whole life story. So when you watch King Richard, you don't see Serena winning Wimbledon. It's just the story up until they went to the tennis world. So American Underdog is literally Kurt Warner's life. And then the last 10 minutes, he goes to the Rams. I go, that's it? I've got Dennis Quaid mailing it in his dick for meal for like an extended cameo? I mean, Mike Marks comes across as this incredible villain. That was the big takeaway. Mike Marks comes across as the most evil offensive coordinator in the history of football. He loved Trent Green. He hated Kurt Warner. But the first 90 minutes, I mean, this is the classic. It'll play well in Peoria. It's about Christian values and Midwestern love and line dancing and square dancing and picking up a woman in a club. Like, this is a tough, tough sell for me. 1.5 Maple Leafs.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Wow, you're going to spoil that part of it. Okay, yeah. No, it's not necessarily surprising. I threw it out there on Twitter, what sports figure deserves a biopic, because I think there's some good ones out there, and there's some obvious ones. Like, Tiger Woods, yes. I think you could do well with a Tiger Woods biopic. But honestly, the more I was thinking about it, Alex Anthopoulos deserves a biopic. I mean, his origin story, I mean, you can see the scene where the Expos leave town and his dad wants him to work at, what was it, an air conditioning dealership or whatever he owned. And he said, no, Dad, I'm following my dreams. And he gets into baseball and he's, hitting the road as a scout. He finally gets a gig with the Blue Jays. And then he gets the big job, his first order of business, trade away Roy Halladay, and then he's about to be fired. He has the crazy deadline in 2015, and he's smoking cigars and covered in champagne, forced out of town, finally wins the World Series in 2021. Like, that's an Oscar winner.
Yeah, if Moneyball can be made, then why can't there be a film made about Alex Anthopoulos? I'm with it. It'll definitely play well to our demographic, which is to say undersized Canadians who love baseball and find an unconventional route to stardom. But I love the question you threw out there, because, of course, the answer is we need a Roger Federer biopic. And while everyone is rolling their eyes in unison, how about, and I don't know how many people have seen West Side Story back in Canada, but Ansel Elgort, who plays the male lead, Google his name right now. That guy looks like a young Federer. I'm watching West Side Story, and I'm swooning over Spielberg. I'm thinking, man, this guy would be pretty good as a young Roger Federer. The real answer, though, and I'm right now in the MLB Network Studio 21, named after Clemente. I don't know how there has not been a Clemente biopic. About 10, 15 years ago, I remember reading an SI. Carmelo Anthony, who was part Puerto Rican, was working on the funding. I went to that All-Star game. This is when I was following Bosch everywhere. I believe it was either in Denver or in Dallas. And I asked Carmelo, I said, hey, how's the Clemente film coming along? He said, yeah, I got a production company. We're working on the script, et cetera. It's never happened. I talked to David Marinus, who's written the definitive book about Clemente. It's an amazing, amazing book. If you've never read Baseball's Passion and Grace of Baseball's Last Hero. And I asked Marinus, and he goes, well, they tried to get it. I don't know what happened, funding, et cetera, but to think we've had a film about Jackie Robinson in 42, but not a film about Clemente. To me, it's a glaring omission as far as sports.
Yeah, I watched it. It's funny you say that, because I watched the American Experience documentary about him last night. It was on PBS last night. So, and it was pretty great. And it did a lot of, kind of kid memories of watching him play and remembering, but if you talk to any Latin American ball player, Ed, then right? Oh. Especially, that it, like the day that Roberto Clemente died is like the day the music died for those guys. It really, he is iconic in a way that is kind of hard to, I'm not sure there's a comparison here in terms of sports figures. So,
And that PBS doc is amazing, because you're right. It shows how influential he was. And I mean, like you said, he's saying it like among Latin Americans. Like, nobody ever forgets who the first one was, and he's literally known as the great one. And when you look at his humanitarian efforts, the 3,000 hits, the way he passed away, I mean, that is ripe for the silver screen.
Mm-hmm. All right, I told Stephen that we'd do one Hall of Fame question, because we did too much Hall of Fame for his liking yesterday. He gave up his vote. He's not a fan of the Baseball Hall of Fame. You're at the MLB Network Studios, though, so we have to ask you, how do we make this thing more fun? Because it's not fun. I love baseball. I love the Hall of Fame. I've been there, but the discourse is not fun. How do we make it more fun?
Well, it definitely does feel like a glaring omission that the greatest hitter I've ever seen and the greatest pitcher I've ever seen are not going to be in the Hall of Fame. So what I suggest is we have a steroid wing. We literally have a giant needle when you get to Cooperstown, and it points you in the direction of all the guys who have been tarnished, and therefore we can all go and admire the exploits of Ivan Rodriguez and Mike Piazza and David Ortiz. But seriously, though, I get the logic. I really do. If someone says, I'm not voting for Bonds or Clemens because of the integrity and character of the game, I got it. But how did Ortiz get in on the first ballot?
Like, there
I
you go.
Laughing.
Thank you.
I started laughing. I'm like, wait a second. 03, he fails a test. It was an anonymous test. I got it. I know he failed the test. May have been a false positive. Okay, I'm not a moron. Like, unless I have a 617 area code and I live in New England, I know the guy was juicing. And by the way, Bonds and Clemens, three-time MVP, three-time Cy Young, then apparently juiced and became superhuman. But they already were great. Poppy was released by the Twins. The guy was washed up. Serge juicing and becomes Ted Williams. Like, at the very least, give the punitive measure, which Stephen knows is a little silly, meaning I'll vote for but not on the first ballot, as if that means a big deal. But fine, it's something. Let me castigate him for a couple of years. You have to wait your turn, sir. We normally would allow you into the club, but you have to wait a couple of years to serve your penance. No, Poppy, come right this way, because you're a gregarious, fun guy, and this is our city, and you're great on TV. Like, that's laughable.
That is, yes, it is. It is correct. It's the good guy. The good guy. Oh boy, you went on the field and say, hey, Poppy, you got a second? I need, oh yeah. Awesome guy. That's how sports writers' brains work. And I'm a sports writer. Honest to God. I can't do this, Adam. I'm sorry. I'm going to leave this to you and Ben. I already did my rant yesterday, Ben.
We did it.
I'm done. I can't do it anymore. But I'm glad you pointed that. Yeah, let's do NFL. Can we do that, please? Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Let's do Sean Payton then, Adnan.
Wait. Because, one more Hall of Fame point, just to drive Brett nuts. I once met a writer. I can't remember who it was, but he said to me he voted for B.J. Surhoff for the Hall of Fame, and I said, "Why the hell would you do that?" And he goes, "I went to school with his dad, and I promised him one day if B.J. Surhoff made the I vote for the Hall of Fame." It's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Go ahead.
The sacred ballot. It's sacred. Don't forget, it's sacred.
Every day that passes, I understand more and more your decision to give up your vote.
Thank you,
Brent.
Thank you.
That's not to say that I wouldn't take one if they offered me the chance to vote on the Hall of Fame. All right. To Sean Payton, he steps away. I mean, after maybe one of his greatest coaching seasons ever, like how that Saints team finished 9-8, I have no idea, Adnan. It looks like he's going to do media at least for 1 year, and he obviously is leaving the door open to return to coaching. He's still under contract, I guess, till 2024 with the Saints, so I guess whoever hires him after maybe a year would have to compensate New Orleans in some way. Doesn't this feel like, you know, he's waiting on the Cowboys to take another step back, and Mike McCarthy's gone, and then he's in Dallas next year.
Ben, bet the house he's going to the Cowboys. Mike Lombardi said this to me a week ago on our podcast, the GM Shuffle, and every Saints fan, they came after us with pitchforks and torches and said, don't you realize he's under contract? This is not the first time if somebody wanted to get out of a contract, they could. You simply resign, and as you expertly said, you give a draft pick or some method of compensation. Mike McCarthy will flail once again. They will underachieve, as the Cowboys perennially do. And then Sean Payton, who has ties to Dallas, who loves Jerry Jones, and Jerry loves Sean, and he's a brilliant coach. He's going to be coaching the Cowboys a year from now. Like, go ahead, write it up. It's done. And the guy's brilliant. And as an Eagles fan, I hate this because I think Sean Payton's a great coach, and this is exactly what Dallas needs. And for New Orleans, as Mike said to me, you generally look at the trajectory of NFL head coaches, it's around a decade. Like Vince Lombardi, a decade, stepped aside, went to Washington, whatever. Bill Walsh, a decade, step aside, go on. So normally after 10 years or so, you kind of feel your own expiration. Why the hell would Sean Payton want to stay with New Orleans, a team with no discernible answer at quarterback, which is well over the salary cap? I mean, there's no reason that I got to stay. As you said, that's superhuman. He drove that team to over 500. Imagine what he'd do with actual talent on a good football team. So TV for fun, and then boom, he'll be there coaching the Dallas Cowboys, which is bad news for everybody else in the NFC East.
Well, I'll tell you, if I was Jerry Jones, I would, you know, I'm not sure I'd send a Micah Parsons for him, but I would make the call right now, you know, and say, hey, what did call the Bensons in New Orleans and say, what's it going to take? Right. Because let's cut to the chase here. Like, you know, because Mike McCarthy's going to be on death watch the entire season. Right. Already is today. Right. It's already tick, tick, tick. When's Mike McCarthy going to get fired so they can bring in Sean Payton? Like, let's cut to the chase here. Right. And it would be the first time.
And if you're a million year old Jerry Jones, who do you want to let another season slip through your fingers before you hire the guy that you intend to hire?
Well, and it'd be the first coach that would be capable of standing up to Jerry Jones a little bit since Jimmy Johnson, right? Like everybody else has been, you know, kind of a pushover for him.
Yeah, I remember when I read the great book by Jeff Perlman, Boys Will Be Boys, which is all the Dallas Cowboys, and Barry Switzer comes across as like the most ineffectual coach ever. Like I kept thinking, oh, Jimmy Johnson gets a lot of credit, but Barry Switzer won one too. There's no doubt Ben Ennis could have coached that team to the Super Bowl. So apparently when they were like partying, Barry Switzer was the one partying more than anybody. So that's proof that a great coach like Jimmy Johnson can elevate teams, and a poor coach can like hide their strengths. You can have anybody there. So Sean Payton's a legit great coach. I'm with you guys. Why wait the year? Everyone knows it's happening anyways. I actually think if I'm Mike McCarthy's camp, I go to Jerry Jones and show some integrity and go, listen, if you don't want me here, that's cool, bro. Just let me know. Pay me my money and I'll go, because I don't need to be on death watch like Sean Penn and Dead Man Walking.
No, 100%. Nice movie reference again. The Aaron Rodgers thing. We've gone over how his playoff history is. I mean, checkered to say the least. He does have the Super Bowl, right? But so many successful regular seasons. Four times that team has won at least 13 games during the regular season, and just the one Super Bowl appearance. If he leaves the Packers, what is his legacy there? Because I'm sure he'll be celebrated. But the way you hear from Packers fans, at least through the prism of Twitter, it really feels like they're about ready to watch him go.
Ben, it's embarrassing. In 30 years of Favre and Rodgers, this is the best they could do. Like, how do you guys not have five Super Bowl titles if you're a fan of the Green Bay Packers? Like, the Ravens have as many Super Bowl titles with Trent Dilfer and Joe Flacco as quarterback over that same amount of time. Like, it's ridiculous. And for Rodgers, listen, he's a brilliant quarterback. He's going to win MVP again for the regular season. But some of this blame he has to wear. Yes, the special teams is a joke. Yes, LaFleur is an overrated head coach. But how does Aaron Rodgers fall again to the Niners' 0-4? The fact he's 5-4 at home in the playoffs. Like, are you kidding? You're supposed to be the great Aaron Rodgers, cold weather quarterback. Jimmy Garoppolo's never even played in cold weather, and you guys can't beat him? Like, it becomes very frustrating. 9-8, as you mentioned, since the Super Bowl. So I think Packers fans go, listen, we know he walks on water, and he's a great player, but too often he's come up short. And I get it. That Niners pass rush was incredible. But somehow, some way, Tom Brady would find a way, or Joe Montana, or John Elway. Aaron Rodgers wilted in that second half. He had 58 passing yards. They had four first downs. Like, even after the Niners came back to that block punt, the Packers offense did nothing. So I think eventually Packers fans will be bawling because they realize Aaron Rodgers is a great player. But I think in the moment right now, they kind of go, you know what? He's probably taking them as far as we can. We're not going to pay $50 million a year. If you're that unhappy, Aaron, fine. Go find something else to do.
Yeah. It's a little, you know, it's I say, like, I didn't hate Dan Marino as much as I hate Aaron Rodgers, but, there are some parallels there.
Absolutely. When it comes to arrogance and guys who kind of get a free pass and people focus on their regular season exploits without looking at the playoffs. I mean, Marino, the greatest insult to Dan Marino fan you could ever say is his last professional game, he lost 62-7. Like, you talk about getting a rude way out the door. Like, hey, Dan, don't let the door hit you on the way out. See ya.
Adnan, always great catching up. Talk again soon.
Highlight of this was the reference to the piano by Stephen Brun. I mean, I want people to go back and look. Holly Hunter plays Ada, a deaf woman who won an Academy Award. Harvey Keitel, full frontal scene. Anna Paquin. I mean, interminable is the best word to describe that film.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it's long and feels longer.
Go check it out.
Full frontal. All right. Okay, very good.
Yes.
See ya, Adnan.
Take care.
See ya. Adnan Virk, MLB Network, NHL Network, GM Shuffle Podcast, and Cinephile, the Adnan Virk movie podcast, where you can hear him talk more about what it was obviously going to be and obviously was a very mediocre at best movie about Kurt Warner called American Underdog. That one was telegraphed, I feel like.
Yeah, no, I think the chances of it being good were pretty much zero, right? Of course, there's also the Sean Payton movie too, right? Like the bad football movies are suddenly all over the place, right? So movies where you think, boy, that can't possibly be good, and you're right, it can't possibly be good.
Where do you stand on sports movies? Because you know what,
there's only one. I'll stop you right now. There's only one we're talking about: Raging Bull.
All right.
Raging Bull, maybe, and again, if Radnan was here, he would be swooning about Scorsese, but it's one of the greatest films ever made, period, and it happens to be about a sport. Well, sort of.
Yeah.
But
I'm not going to fight you on that. Yeah, okay, so that's where you stand, because it's tough. I think it's tough sitting in the seats that we sit in where sports is our profession, and it's all sports, 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 to go to your leisure time and then watch more sports, right? Like, I do understand that maybe there's a jaded element, and, like, Moneyball should have been made specifically for me. Like, I should have gobbled up, and I watch Moneyball, and it's fine, but I don't love it. Like, because I understand that there were no real stakes. It's like, the stakes is winning 20 in a row. Great. Oh, it was spectacular. And they made the playoffs in a crappy division, and they had some of the greatest starting pitching of that generation, and they disappointed. They were a disappointing franchise. I understand that they changed the game. But, yeah, I'm too close to sports. I will say that Bull Durham is – come on, how can you not? You're anti-Bull Durham, too?
It's okay. Slapshot, same. You know, there'll be a whole bunch of people yelling Slapshot from, you know, in the in this country. So, okay, you know. Talking about a great film, like Pride of the Yankees wasn't a great film. It's, you know, the Jackie Robinson film was not very good, I didn't think. I was just super disappointed in it. It's kind of, you know, again, one-dimensional for a guy who was not one-dimensional. Yeah. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of hard to stack stuff up against, especially if you saw the reality of it. It's, you know, it's easier to do something like Bull Durham where, you know, it's you're not trying to replicate something that's in people's memories.
Well, yeah, and so many. I mean, I think the term Adnan uses, formulaic. Like, when you have a sports movie, there's an obvious formula. Even in my Alex Anthopoulos movie, he exits the field as the conquering hero, right? Like, it ends positively. You're right. Raging Bull is quite good. Like, you're on an island saying that, but. Yeah, it's a good one. When we come back, let's talk to Frank Saravelli of DailyFaceoff.com. Trade deadline, kind of fast approaching. What do the Leafs do, and how do the Canadian restrictions impact the potential luring of trade partners? We'll talk to Frank about that coming up next. The Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.